Welcome to New Books in World Affairs. This is your host, Christian Peterson. And today I have the good fortune of speaking with Caton Mistry about his new book, The United States, Italy, and the Origins of Cold War, Waging Political Warfare, 1945 to 1950, which is put out by Cambridge University Press. Caton, welcome to the show.
Hi, Christian. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you today. Before we begin, I was wondering if you could give us a brief, for lack of a better term, a look at your background and how you came to write the book.
Yeah, sure. In terms of who I am, I'm a lecturer in American history at the University of East Anglia in Norwich. So for your sort of American listeners, that would be the equivalent of an assistant professor. And I've been here since about 2012. My specialism is in American foreign policy, particularly international Cold War, looking at how particularly state and non-government groups between the U.S. and Europe participated in the conflict, and as well as the intelligence. And these are the sort of the areas in which I research and teach. In terms of my background, I'm the son of immigrants. My family moved to the U.K. from India back in the 1960s. So I'm sort of the first generation that was born and raised in the UK. And sort of growing up, this led to quite an interesting, a rich experience of being sort of both inside and outside of different cultures, having something of a sort of hybrid identity. I guess my interest in sort of the intersections between cultures, identities, and nations have been sort of rooted in that. I've had a sort of quite an international outlook because of my background, but also through my education and training, I suppose. I did my undergraduate and graduate work here in the UK. I got my PhD from the University of Birmingham and then went on to postdocs in Ireland at University College Dublin. And I've also had fellowships at the Universities of Warwick and Oxford. But I spent a lot of time abroad during these years, particularly in the United States and Italy. So I've also studied at UCLA, the University of California, Los Angeles, had a fellowship at NYU, and also periods at the universities of Bologna and Padua in Italy. And these are periods that have been sort of very influential in terms of shaping the project, the questions I would ask, the research agendas, and, of course, some of the conclusions. And, of course, they were wonderful places to be based as well.
Yeah, my wife spent a semester, and actually, no, it was a year, studying abroad at UC Dublin.
Oh, right.
And she keeps talking about it as one of the this amazing experience she has. She still brings that up from time to time. So that must have been a great time you had there.
Yeah, it was a fantastic place, and I remember fondly my office. I could see the sea on a clear day. It was a great place to be. Not that you can see the sea often, because it would rain a fair bit, but it was a fantastic place. I had a wonderful time there.
That's good. Before we go into the arguments of your book in more detail, I was wondering if you could give the listeners a synopsis of your the book.
Yeah, sure. On a very basic level, the book is analyzing U.S.-Italian relations and also broader American efforts to conceptualize and practically wage a Cold War. I guess it's addressing two questions which are interrelated in many ways. The first one would be looking at how Italy, which was something of a peripheral concern for the United States in Europe after World War II, how this case becomes a seminal front in the post-war struggle against communism. And then the second question was how the supposed lessons from this case, the defeat of the Italian left, the Marxist left, supposedly outlined a way for the United States to successfully wage a Cold War through political warfare. What was political warfare? It was an approach to foreign relations that coordinated all the covert and overt measures short of war at a nation's command. And this was seen as particularly appropriate for this era, the aftermath of World War II, when the contours of international conflict were very much in flux. Things were quite different. You know, the Cold War is a very commonly recognized label. You know, when we teach in the classroom, or if you were to sort of speak with somebody on the street, the Cold War is something that you don't necessarily have to define. It's sort of well recognized. But I think it's also misunderstood in many respects. Just the term itself is somewhat oxymoronic. You know, war by definition involves armed conflict. It's hostile, it's bloody, it's messy, it's violent.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could explain to the listeners why the 1948 elections or election in Italy is such an important moment in the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you think of elections in 1948, people will think of the one in the United States. There was another election earlier in the year which had just as many ramifications or just as much significance. 1948 Italian election was the first national vote after the end of fascism. It represented a pivotal moment for Italians and their newfound republic, but it also had a lot of ramifications for the United States, a lot of significance. It marked the first major mobilization by the U.S. government after World War II to influence events abroad. It was the first Cold War intervention. It was the first occasion in which the newly formed CIA got involved abroad to try to swing foreign affairs. So it's the crucial episode, the Italian election, in the development and organization of American political warfare. The campaign was conducted below the level of total military conflict, so all of these measures short of war. And the fact that Italians rejected the Marxist left in the vote of April 1948 appeared as tangible proof that political warfare could defeat communism both in Italy but also around Europe. It was sort of seen as a way to defeat Soviet communism more generally. So the Italian election in American eyes represented a unique way to fight, fighting abroad without having to actually fire a gun or drop a bomb. And it was seen as the first occasion in which the U.S. had waged a war short of actual war.
Yeah, it is an interesting moment, and you use it to make a number of important arguments about the conduct of U.S. foreign policy and U.S. Italian relations in general. I was wondering if you could say more about some of the other main arguments that you advance in this book.
Yeah, so when I started this project, I was confronted, as many people do, with large literatures on the topic, and this one had two remarkably large ones. You've got the sort of body of work on U.S.-Italian relations, the transition from fascism to democracy, relations between the two nations, then the origins of the Cold War, which is enormous. Lots of works on the early Cold War. Some have mentioned the Italian election, but often it's in passing, part of a familiar narrative, including long telegram, writings of George Kennan, the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan. And the Italian election sort of fits this chronology, if you will. But the references are often sort of quite superficial, if you will. So what I was trying to do is link these two literatures between the broad conflict and the local one to give a more rounded account. So I look at the efforts of both state and private actors on both sides of the Atlantic. So obviously the governments, but also a range of religious, civil, labor, and business groups. You've got European governments who are involved. Britain, France, Ireland are quite active around the Italian election. You obviously have the Vatican, which has quite a prominent stake in affairs in Italy. You have labor groups like the American Federation of Labor, banks, financial companies, multinationals, Standard Oil, General Electric. Then you also have sort of prominent figures within the United States. You have publishers like Henry Luce, the proprietor of Time Life, the Empire Time Life. You have entertainers like Frank Sinatra. You also have cultural figures. You have sports stars. People like Joe DiMaggio are involved in this election campaign. So it's one of my aims was to challenge the sort of traditional assumptions in diplomatic history of sort of top-down elite policy making. You have a very eclectic, varied list of individuals and groups who are involved in both U.S. foreign relations and also ties between the U.S. and Italy. So I have the book sort of puts forward what I'd say three key arguments. The first is that Italy was never important in and of itself for senior American policymakers. And I'll reiterate the senior element here, although its fate was quite important in a broader sense. An unstable Italy undermined some of these broader post-war plans, things like the Marshall Plan. So defeating the Italian left was central to American understanding and both the and also the prosecution of the Cold War. So the book looks to examine the origin and definition of Cold War as a concept, as well as how it was fought through political warfare. I quite consciously sort of not use the definite article "the," for instance. The second key argument is that the Cold War obviously concerned a number of American officials and commentators, but this sort of bipolar conflict, short of war, was less prominent, less pressing for Italians, and the range of sort of private groups were involved here. In other words, the election was more than just a Cold War flashpoint. So you've got lots of alternative visions, alternative agendas from Italian national sovereignty, pan-Catholic political spiritual unity, and apolitical global trade unionism. And you've got all of these sort of narratives that are at play, if you will. So it's not just a question of Cold War. And then the third key argument is that the most sort of telling legacy, if you will, of the Italian election was the emergence of a perception of success in American circles. The supposed lessons of this election in Italy and the campaign that it could help wage a Cold War more generally. And sort of my aim here is not critiquing the ideological dispositions as flawed or making normative claims as to what constitutes success. I'm quite clear, I think, in the book about what my own view is, that the perception of success was largely ungrounded, yet this is sort of irrelevant in some respects. The key thing is that the notion that American efforts had succeeded in Italy was unequivocal. You can kind of dispute whether it was accurate or not, but it was indisputably prominent in the minds of many policymakers. I think the key issue is to understand how this perception of success came about, and furthermore, sort of consider the consequences. And what I try to do is show how it emerged and fueled a problematic future for U.S.-Italian relations, but also American political warfare as it expanded around Europe and soon afterwards the world.
Yeah, and it makes for a fascinating read. Yeah, I'm glad you wrote the book. I had, you know, a lot of the traditional views of the moment, of the place of Italy in post-war politics, especially the election in April 1948, that, to be perfectly blunt, you changed my mind on. I guess the place to go here is to see how you develop your arguments. Let's start with the place of U.S.-Italian relations right after World War II and the immediate aftermath of the war. As you describe, the U.S.-Italian relations weren't exactly always, for lack of a better word, people weren't on the same page. They were a bit rocky at times. I was wondering if you could say more about the evolution of U.S.-Italian relations right after World War II.
Italy always posed a real problem for American policymakers, also for other major statesmen, European statesmen, and it's not something that was unique just to the aftermath of World War II. I mean, in the way of a very brief sort of prehistory, if you will, Italy had posed problems ever since World War I, the aftermath of World War I, and the Paris Peace Conference. Of the Big Four, an image which has been circulated a lot given with the recent wave of books and discussion about the Great War that has come in the last sort of during the last year. You see that famous image of the Big Four, the fourth person of the Big Four, the Italian Prime Minister Vittorio Emanuele Orlando is often the sort of forgotten man. He famously storms out of the Paris Peace Conference, refuses to sign the treaty. This, of course, is the contributes to the rise of Mussolini. There is, of course, a big discussion. There's a large sort of amount of work that, discusses this. United States, American policymakers at first welcome Italian fascism in the belief that Mussolini would sort of ensure order as Europe was confronting the economic stability of the era, particularly during the 1930s. And the rising threat of post-Bolshevism. This, of course, changes World War II. The story is quite well known. But the American experience of fighting in Italy raises a number of problems. In short, Italy has what I term a Janus-faced wartime experience. It had fought, obviously, with the Axis, but it was also a defeated Axis collaborator. It had finished on the side of the Allies, but had previously aligned with, Hitler. It was a enemy ally, which meant that it was both victor and vanquished. On a practical level, what it meant was that Italy was subject to a peace treaty in the same way that other Axis collaborators were. But at the same time, it was also a nation which had very strong links with the what major Western powers, had made a contribution, particularly with sort of Italian partisans, towards the liberation of Europe and the expulsion of fascism. So this, I guess, is the backstory as to why Italy was a complicated case for the United States. As we come into sort of 1945, the end of 1945.
Yeah, and I'd completely forgotten about the peace treaty and the disputes about Italian borders that obviously have origins back to World War One, even before that. I thought that was an interesting thing to bring into the table. So you have this situation where the Americans are trying to figure out what to do with Italy and Western Europe in general. And what you do in your book is describe how these concerns about Italy kind of overlap with the evolution of this idea of Cold War and waging Cold War. And what you do is you develop these ideas, you make reference to events in Italy. One of the strengths of the book is that to use a buzzword from academia, the agency of Italian actors.
Right.
So the story is how Americans and Italians understood events and began, sometimes work together, sometimes not work together. So my question is, how did the United States begin to pay more attention how did they begin to pay more attention to what was going on in Italy?
Right. Initially, of course, American British troops had played a key role in liberating the Italian peninsula. For many American troops, this was the very first, Italy was the very first experience of practically fighting in World War II. The US and the British continued to maintain military presence with troops on the ground in Italy in the aftermath, after the armistice was signed, of course. You have a period of great flux, I think, between sort of the end of fighting in World War II and what historians have commonly sort of classified as the beginnings of the Cold War, around the sort of 1946 to 1947 period. There's good reason why this is identified as sort of the origins or the start of the Cold War, but I think there's a lot of it's quite important or quite useful to kind of go back and sort of look at some of the debates that were taking place at the time. There was not a clear discussion or a clear sort of consensus in the debates at the time that this was the beginning of a Cold War. This is a term that's in some respects retrospectively been used and placed on the past, on this period, to describe a period which was quite uncertain. People were grasping to understand what this new era was, what this kind of conflict represented. So while we while we easily look back to this period and identify it as the origins of a Cold War, it was less certain, I think, at the time. And this is where sort of the ideas of somebody like George Kennan, who features very prominently in my text, are quite useful in sort of clarifying this. There was very little definition. You have people sort of trying to understand what it is, what the circumstances exactly meant, what was the conditions. The world was not in a time of war, but neither was it a time of pure peace as well. And the discussions in Italy, I think, are quite interesting, or some of the events there. You mentioned the Cold War. In this sort of 1945 to 46 period, interestingly, Italian officials, I think, are the ones who are sort of trying to emphasize the dangers that Italy is facing at the time. The Truman Doctrine, one of these key moments which are often cited, obviously, of course, in discussions of the early Cold War. When the Truman administration first announced its request for aid to Greece and Turkey, you have Italian officials who are trying to make explicit links and parallels between the situation in Greece and Turkey with Italy. This is outright rejected by the Truman administration. They do not want to Italian officials using this as a way to try to gain more to elicit more assistance from the United States. They are actually rejecting sort of the parallels there. I think one of the key moments, or the key turning points, if you will, that changes the debate and Italy's place within American priorities will come with the Marshall Plan, which of course is comes shortly afterwards.
Yeah, it's interesting how you mentioned that. One of the major arguments of your book, that in general, Italy did not start off as a major Cold War concern of America. And it took a number of events, and it took a lot of lobbying from Italian officials, even to some degree non-governmental actors. That's what we'll talk about in a little bit. But I always thought that right from the beginning, almost, Italy was right up there as a place that the West had to have to rebuild Western Europe. So you mentioned in your answer about the Italian officials and trying to forge links with or deal with American officials. I was wondering if you could say a bit more about how Italian politics unfolded and how they dealt with, you can weigh in on this, and you have to some degree already, about the Cold War and, the Christian Democrats trying to, control political events as best they could.
Yeah. I suppose when we're talking about events inside Italy, it is a very, as domestic politics often is, this is incredibly messy. Italian team, perhaps more than most countries, primarily because of the lack of a clear sort of divide between, say, the left and the right, which you find particularly in the United States, but also countries like Great Britain, for example. Italy never has that, and to some extent probably still doesn't have that today. So this was probably one of the key areas where there were difficulties in terms of sort of American understanding of the political scene. The idea that you could create, or there would be two clear blocks, the Marxist left and then those aligned against the Marxist left. To an extent, this is one of the sort of issues on which the 1948 election would be, one of the key ways that the election would be pitched. The problem was within the sort of the anti-communist or the non-Marxist segment, there was a huge plethora of views, lots of different groups, lots of different schisms and factions within groups. And you see this with the most important or the dominant political actor in post-war, the Italian Prime Minister, Alcide De Gasperi. He is the head of the government, of course, but his ascent to that position is a very complicated and difficult one, involving lots of compromise and also having to balance numerous factions, both within his party, but also trying to gain the support of the Catholic Church, but at the same time try to keep the Catholic Church's influence at arm's length. He didn't want to be. He wanted to resist excessive church influence on both his party, but also Italian politics more generally. One of the key themes for somebody like De Gasperi was to maintain and assert Italian sovereignty. This is a very young country, newfound republic, came into existence early in 1946. He went to great lengths to ensure that the Italian Republic was free from outside influence, which meant communism, but also excessive influences from the United States and also the Vatican itself.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's definitely you don't get the sense that somehow the American one of the problems in U.S. diplomatic history in general is this assumption, and it's almost. For lack of a better term, it's accepted and sometimes not challenged like it should be, that the people across the globe are just sitting there responding to what the United States does. That's what, they do. It's just they don't have any of their own kind of, concerns domestically or their own ideologies. It's all what the U.S. does, and it's a response. And I think what your book does is show that that's not necessarily the case. I mean, when it fit his interests, De Gasperi definitely tried to use American aid and standing with America to accomplish his own domestic agendas. He wasn't, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of the time he wasn't being forced to do anything that he didn't perceive as in his interest.
This is one of the key debates that's taking place, that historians have debated, particularly in the sort of last 10, 15 years, right? How do we talk about and how do we discuss America's role in the world? Can you do that without paying attention to partners, but also groups that the United States will collaborate with, not all of whom are state actors, of course. There is an issue of documents, sources, methodology here, of course. The United States has, you have much more access to archival material in the United States than you do in a lot of even Western European countries. So there is that issue here that's at work that influences a lot of scholarship. Slowly, the situation is improving, and historians have started to draw on the material that you find in state archives in other nations. But not just at a state level. I think one of the most interesting areas that the field is going in is looking at the contribution of non-state actors. So I sort of briefly mentioned the role, for example, of the Vatican, but then also you have important actors like labor organizations, Italian-American groups in this instance, but also private businesses as well, which I think overall gives a much more complete picture and a more interesting sort of account of these, what were genuinely international and transnational sort of moments, if you will. I wanted to just go back one second to sort of we were discussing earlier about the origins of the Cold War. One of the things that I tried to do in the book is to sort of understand this period to explore what we understand by Cold War. It's a term which is bandied around obviously quite a lot, but in some respects the term itself is somewhat oxymoronic. How do you have a war without actually waging a hot military conflict? This is one of the debates that was taking place in this I found it so interesting is there is this window of time between World War II and Korea, which are in some respects the bookends to my project, when there is this discussion. Hot war was widely considered undesirable and also impractical. There's great uncertainty of the shape of this new struggle, and it's events like Italy which help officials, which help the general public sort of grasp what it is that this new conflict was and how it would be fought. And this is where sort of the Italian election episode, I think, it brings these debates into sharp focus. It's certainly used by officials like Kennan and other prominent American policymakers, but also commentators, influential figures in the press, to help give better definition to what it was, or what it was, what the Cold War represented, and how it would manifest.
Yeah, that's. I want to get back to. We're gonna talk more about the non-governmental aspect of your study, but I think it's a good segue how you worded that to the evolution of the idea of political warfare among American policymakers. I was wondering if you could say more about how that concept evolves, and if you would, you can talk briefly about what goes on, the ad hoc nature of U.S. Political warfare efforts.
Yeah. I guess for first thing, it's probably quite useful for listeners to sort of define what I mean by political warfare. Simply put, it was the sort of employment of all the measures at the nation's command to achieve its foreign policy objectives, short of full-scale hot war. This was something which George Kennan spends a lot of time emphasizing. A lot of his memos, a lot of his own work and research in this period revolves around this idea of international conflict without full-scale military competition. The ad hoc nature of it is, in some respects, linked to the uncertainty around the period. Most Americans, like most people around the world at this time, understood conflict as distinctly, or within the realms of total military conflict. Two world wars had given, you could clearly understand hot war. This was something that happened in wartime. Peacetime, there was a time of no international conflict, or at least not in that sense. So the attempt to influence affairs in countries like Italy, like the episode of the Italian election, was in some respects an exploration in the dark, if you will. As a result, many of the attempts were ad hoc. You didn't have the infrastructure that was commonplace, obviously, during wartime. You didn't have full-time proper. There were no full-time permanent covert operations agencies and activities. As a result, many of the initiatives and the activities that the United States ends up engaging in are quite improvised, led by groups that you wouldn't anticipate or expect to be engaged in these sort of activities. The American Embassy, for one, was one of the most important actors in the run-up to the 1948 Italian election. You have the American Ambassador, James Dunn, who plays a very prominent role, much more than one would imagine for the official diplomatic representative of the United States towards Italy.
Yeah, and another person you mentioned. Tell me, I might maybe pronouncing his name incorrectly. I don't have it written down in front of me. Is it Luigi Gaeta?
Jetta,
about from an American Catholic organization, I believe, who effectively presented or played in this kind of political warfare game. I mean, maybe he didn't necessarily think of himself as doing it, but effectively presented American positions much better than you would think for someone who wasn't trained in the art of, you know, deception. So I thought that was an interesting layer to your study.
Yeah,
and
it's interesting.
Go ahead.
I'm glad you mentioned Jedi because he's a very interesting character. I mean, he himself has no training. He has no background in propaganda. He's a trained physician, and he heads up the Vatican-controlled civic committees. These were normally independent organizations, but they had very close links to the Vatican. And they were units that would it was a very strong grassroots network, and it plays a very important role in the lead up to the election in terms of getting out the message in terms of the Catholic world, emphasizing the importance of firstly turning out to vote, and secondly not voting for the Marxist left. Right, the line. Quite well established now by lots of sort of work that's emphasized the importance of religion in American foreign relations, particularly in the Cold War, was that you could not vote for an atheist, totalitarian party which had links with godless communism centered in Moscow, right? So Jeddah is a guy who has the ear of the Pope, and he is incredibly effective in mobilizing communities. They would go to small villages, set up projectors, pass out a lot of information about the importance of voting and voting for the non-communist party. You mentioned that the American sort of interest in Jeddah, they were quite fascinated by his methods, also the applicability of what he was doing to other nations, other Western European countries where there were prominent Catholic populations. The thing was, while Jeddah was quite effective in terms of what he was doing, it was specifically attuned to Italian conditions. The message that he and the Vatican were putting out was quite different to the one that the United States was emphasizing. Yes, they didn't want the communists in power, but neither did they want the sort of the brand of American free market liberal capitalism that the Truman administration was obviously favoring in Italy. For Jeddah, for the Vatican, they envisaged a very strong papal influence in Italian political, social, and cultural life. And this was one of the key messages that, in some respects, was overlooked by many American observers and American officials at the time, behind this propaganda. So it has the civic committees and people like Jeddah were influential, but they were not necessarily pushing the same agenda that the United States was in favor of. And this was one of the examples of how these marriages of convenience, a term that I use in the book, had useful short-term gains, but there were numerous complications to these sort of short-term alliances as you go further down the line.
Yeah, that's a very effective part of the book. I mean, even when the Truman administration was working with the Vatican or, you know, the Catholic Church, various organizations, some Americans were going crazy thinking of the United
right.
States working with the Pope. I mean, maybe not typical is the right word, but kind of the anti-Catholicism, it was still a major issue in American, you know, politics.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly, 1945.
Yeah, I mean, this pulled a lot of heat on Truman himself back at home. You had Protestant groups, major Protestant denominations, lining up to go and see him in the White House to protest firstly, the continuation of the president's personal representative to the Pope, which was something that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had set up, of course, during World War II. And Truman continued with this post. Myron Taylor, who was the guy who was sent to the Vatican, Taylor got a lot of was on the receiving end of a lot of criticism from domestic groups in the United States, Protestant groups in the United States, for his mission. Truman came under a lot of attack as well. It created a lot of domestic grief for him. And this is an interesting sort of factor when we talk, as I sort of mentioned earlier, a lot of historians have paid much more attention to the importance of religion. But it's not until 1984 that the U.S. and the Vatican officially exchange diplomatic representatives, right? You don't have a formal exchange of ambassadors until the 1980s. You know, if the Cold War was partly a struggle for of faith, of Christian nations, or the importance of having or the importance of religion against atheist communism, it's quite an interesting sort of point that it's not until the 1980s that you have formal recognition between the United States and the Vatican. Of course, the Vatican is not a state, even though it does have a significant diplomatic presence in the world.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that. I was just at the Reagan Library doing research, and I came across, and I've seen him online as well, Reagan's personal correspondence with John Paul II. His letters back and forth are pretty interesting reading. And once again, I think it goes to your point, is that a lot, for lack of a better term, the Pope was sometimes very critical of Reagan's military policies in these letters, and Reagan kind of just took it and just said, you know, oh, well, or maybe not oh, well is the right word, but he definitely took it in stride that the Pope was still, they were fighting on the same side, even though he was taking, you know, some shots, I mean, very guarded shots at Reagan's kind of nuclear weapons policies. So, yeah, that is an interesting point.
Mm. I mean, and getting back... Parallel, oh, sorry, the Pope Pius was also quite critical of the American president back in the 1940s. He was very cautious in terms of sort of the extent of the sort of alliance between the U.S. And the Vatican. And he recognized the importance or the weight of the United States in the post-war era, but he was also very cautious and hesitant for a strong American influence, again, over Italian political, social, and cultural, and perhaps more importantly, spiritual life. So you have this battle for influence going on between groups who are between two entities who are normally very closely aligned. Particularly, this is something that's emphasized a lot in the run up to the election of 1948.
Yes, and as you know, as events move towards the election of 1948, April 1948, you see the evolution of the United States trying to figure out how to approach political warfare and by extension, the Cold War. And George Kennan, obviously, a lot of your chapter five deals with Kennan. I was wondering if you could kind of describe his, you know, influence or lack of influence on U.S. policy and how you evaluate him as an actor in your work.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Kennan is someone who I've written a little bit on Kennan before I published this book, and I sort of vowed not to sort of harp on about him too much. But like all best intentions, I ended up having to sort of swallow my words, and Kennan appears again quite prominently. It's difficult, it's not impossible to discuss the origins of the Cold War and looking at Kennan, partly because of his influence. I mean, he wasn't the all-seeing strategic sage that some of the accounts, or most popular accounts, have sort of suggested. But he's very important, I think, in terms of giving better definition to what this era of not being at war but not being at peace in the traditional sense was like. He obviously leaves a vast record as well. You know, he's a wonderful writer, incredibly insightful, very insecure, pessimistic. He would be he would later be obviously become also famous for his historical work. He's a fascinating figure, and I think that some of the attention he receives from historians and myself, I'd include myself in this, is that he's just a fascinating figure whose record is so rich. He provides so much material. He elucidates and describes sort of the events of the time in quite a striking way. So my take on Kennan, I mean, the traditional, or Kennan's most famous, is Kennan is known most to your listeners, I imagine, as being for his ideas around containment. There's a big discussion amongst academics about the nature of his containment, right? A political and military strategy. This was a topic that scholars really grappled with from the 1970s, and in some respects continue to discuss today. It's quite remarkable the amount of material there is on Kennan, and there's more coming out all the time, particularly with the opening of his the full opening of his private papers and diaries, etc. That a figure who never holds a senior government position has received so much attention in countless books and articles. As I mentioned, much of this revolves on the idea of Kennan as the father of containment, which is something that I personally don't sort of believe he was. My sort of take is much more, is along the lines of the importance of his contemporary thinking. Now, this was not on the basis, his contemporary thinking was not on strategy or producing a blueprint for U.S. foreign relations. Rather, it was about sort of the art of foreign policy, if you will, in this post-World War II era, an atomic one, of course, where these sort of traditional conceptions of war and peace were increasingly obsolete. No, they weren't entirely meaningless, but they weren't as meaningful as before, perhaps, the two world wars. One of the things that Kennan kept coming back to was how you confront an enemy in peacetime without resorting to hot, military, violent, total war, right? How could one wage mm-hmm. a war short of actual war? And this was, in many respects, the crucial question, both conceptually and practically. And for Kennan, the answer appears in, or the way he formulates it, is through political warfare, right? The nascent Cold War wouldn't manifest as a traditional military conflict with two armies facing up against one another. Rather, it was about all the measures at a nation's command short of war to achieve its national objectives. Kennan, I should point out, is not the only one to advocate this. Right? You have other important administration officials like the Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal, Alan Dulles, who's a private citizen, but he's involved in several sort of committees, but also prominent New York Times commentators. But Kennan explains, he provides the strongest intellectual rationale and expresses it more clearly than perhaps some of the others.
Yeah, you raise a good issue. What surprised me, maybe surprised is not the best word, but I found very interesting was how he wrote about Italy in his writings. Yeah. I mean, talking about the fragility, almost you talk about how he used feminine language to describe the inability of the Italians to resist the authoritarian temptation, so to speak. I guess it's not exactly shocking per se, but it was interesting that he was that convinced that Italians needed to be propped up. That's not, I mean, something I've read that much. I'm not a Kennan expert by any means, but I haven't read that much in the literature.
Yeah, I mean, Kennan, and this is one of the, I think one of the reasons why he continued to fascinate historians is that he leaves such a long paper trail. He puts down things on paper that other officials simply did not, would not, could not. Kennan is a man of the North in many respects. I mean, his family origins. He grows up in Wisconsin. He's a great fan of Scandinavia, of Russia, of Germany, sort of Anglo-Saxon democracy. He's very suspicious of what he would consider sort of Latin peoples, and Italy would fall within that sort of categorization. His disdain, or his suspicions rather, towards the Latin character is something that you see in several guises. I think you can sort of trace some of the ideas to his, say, policy recommendations. For example, his views towards NATO. He was quite opposed to including Italy in the same way that he was opposed to including countries like Greece, partly on geographic grounds, but also because of this notion of what Anglo-Saxon, North Atlantic security and democratic ideals and values stood for. And there's a personal angle as well, as this kind of has been widely noted and discussed. Kennan was married to a Norwegian. He spends a lot of time in Scandinavia, in Norway during his life. He likes he genuinely values the calm, rational way, is how he puts it, that people go about their business, rather than the hot-headed and impetuous way that life would manifest in the Mediterranean. You should point out he knows very little about the Mediterranean or Latin America or the sort of idea of pan-Latinism, if you will. But that didn't stop Kennan from musing on it on several occasions.
Yeah, I come from a similar background as Kennan. I grew up in Minnesota. I'm from a very Scandinavian family. My grandmother at times preferred to speak Norwegian.
Oh, okay.
And definitely emotion was not something that was prized in my upbringing among my family. I can tell you that. I'd hate to keep going on Kennan, but one more point, then we'll move away from Kennan, and you see this in the other literature, he has these moments of absolute depression, like almost like going to the corner, like my 3-year-old likes to do when he doesn't get what he wants and sulks. And why I bring this up, and then it was interesting that at points, like you said, he puts things on paper that necessarily people won't do, and you can correct me if I'm getting the details wrong, but he did something like advocate that martial law be declared and that the leftist, I believe the Communist Party, outlawed, because he was so convinced at one point that Italy would fall to the left and be a Cold War victory. He advocated like something like that on paper that people thought was crazy advice.
So this is what's infamously noted as Kennan's Manila telegram. This is a message that he sends on the eve of the Italian election, in which panicked, he's genuinely fearful that the Marxist left, the Communist Party and its socialist allies, are going to win the Italian vote. And in this panic, he suggests that rather than let the left wing win the election legally in a bloodless coup, he suggests outlawing the Communist Party. He's fully aware that this will probably lead to a civil war, but he suggests that, well, it would be better to partition the country with perhaps a U.S.-friendly regime in the south and the communists taking the north, with the United States being able to secure more important military positions in the south of Italy on the Italian peninsula. He's way off on this. I mean, he's out of the loop, actually. The reason why he's in Manila is that he's coming back to the United States from Japan, where he's been to assess the situation there. He hasn't really been following the most recent reports in the early part of 1948 about what's happening in Italy. he is not aware that the left is predictions are that the left is not going to win, but he's greatly troubled by this idea. Now, Kennan's ideas are quickly of this suggestion is quickly nipped in the bud. The more sensible heads and opinions prevail, but it's kind of it gets to a couple of points. Firstly, I mean, Kennan, there is a lot of attention on him, and as I've sort of mentioned, he features fairly prominently in my text, but he's not the most important official when it comes to American policy making, and particularly not when it comes to what the United States does in the lead up to the Italian election. But on a more general point, I think this episode is very interesting because it also reflects Kennan's profound sort of sense of disappointment at American political warfare. So Kennan outlines, he provides the most effective case for why the United States needs to wage a war short of actually going to war. But he's consistently disappointed with the way that the United States does this. And I think this really comes up with this suggestion of outlawing the Communist Party. His argument is that, well, if we had effectively used all of these means short of war, used propaganda effectively, used covert influences, then we wouldn't be in this position. And this is a theme that he returns to in the aftermath of the election and the victory for the Christian Democrats, that it went well, but it could easily have not gone well. And we need to prevent this from happening again. We can't have these ad hoc initiatives. Effective political warfare will ensure that there is no there's no risk of going of hot war breaking out. And the Manila Telegram was kind of a reflection of his profound disappointment at what the United States was doing. Something which he would express time and time again over
yes.
a long, distinguished and career and life.
Yeah, that's true. I can't believe how long he lived. I think he lived, what was it, like 103 when he died?
Right.
Amazing. Go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry.
Okay. I guess that's a great segue into the next issue, the election in 18 April 1948. And you've touched on it a little bit, but I thought you might want to develop the idea a little bit further of why many Americans saw this as vindicating their approach, or they saw it, their political warfare, they saw it as a success, and in what ways that idea of success might, it did in the long term prove very misleading.
Yeah, I guess the election result brought about a fairly convincing victory for the Christian Democrats. As I've sort of hinted at or suggested in some of the previous discussion, this was on account of numerous factors, numerous groups that are involved, partly the Vatican, the Civic Committee, also, quite importantly, the campaign waged launched by the Christian Democrats themselves. But these were not factors that were in the forefront of American policymakers and commentators. So was finally announced. I mean, American policymakers and commentators were firstly relieved, but moreover, they were quite ecstatic at the outcome because they saw this as a vindication of their efforts of American intervention in the Italian election itself. These efforts, short of war, particularly the propaganda campaign, were seen as playing a crucial role in swinging the electoral scales away from the Marxist left. There is this intense debate that takes place in the days and the weeks after about the different initiatives, particularly the propaganda surrounding, say, the Marshall Plan, how this was so influential in checking the communist threat, the spread of communist influence from Eastern Europe to Western Europe. And there are these discussions about expanding this this campaign or these initiatives to firstly consolidate Western Europe, but then also to expand some of these initiatives into Eastern Europe itself, to start to undermine and chip away at Soviet influence over Eastern European states.
Yeah, and what's interesting about it is how much, at least in the instance of Italy, how much of the, you know, clandestine operations were run outside the purview of the CIA. It doesn't, you know, beyond the ad hoc features and a lot of the stuff coming out of the embassy, that the National Security Council created institutions to carry that out that the CIA didn't have direct control over, which eventually changes. So I was wondering if you could say something about where the CIA fits into this or doesn't fit into these, you know, the election and, you know, the for lack of a better term, the efforts to get rid of the Italian left.
Yeah. So the CIA, one of the sort of foundational myths of the CIA is that when it comes to covert action and covert operations is that it cuts its teeth in Italy in the 1948 election campaign. It plays a decisive role. This is one of the stories that many of its sort of covert operators would recount and repeat. This was the first not only American intervention in the early Cold War, but the first CIA operation. And to an extent, it's true that it was the first CIA operation, but it was incredibly small scale. Much of the discussion revolves around passing money to certain non-communist groups. But much of the many of the sources to corroborate this are incredibly problematic. The CIA has not released its operational files, even during the 1990s when it was going through a period of great openness, as the then CIA director Robert Gates, who of course, until quite recently, was Secretary of Defense under both Bush and Obama. He announced that a new period of openness, coinciding with sort of the end of the Cold War, greater transparency, and promised the declassification of a number of records pertaining to sort of covert operations. And Italy was slated as one of them, but no records were ever released. As a result, many of these claims are based on accounts from participants who were intimately involved in these operations, people who have vested interest in emphasizing the efficiency and importance of these actions. But going back to sort of the operations and what we do know about them, the CIA had a very small capability at the time of the Italian election. One of the things that I do in the book is sort of show how many of the more sort of systematic attempts to provide assistance to both the Christian Democrats but also the non-communist socialist left in Italy came from groups outside of the agency. So the State Department, it's the embassy, of course, private groups like the American Federation of Labor, Vatican organizations. But then you also have ad hoc efforts led by people like Alan Dulles, James Forrestal, and the reason why they were weighing in at a relatively late stage in the day was a profound sense of disappointment towards the CIA for not sort of mobilizing and providing sufficient covert assistance to the non-communist Italian groups. There's a lot of institutional debate and discussion, warfare, if you will, but there's also personal gripes. The head of the CIA at the time, Chuck Gorosko Hillingcutt, was incredibly cautious. He was very reluctant for the agency to be involved in these sort of activities, and quite often he was, if not bypassed, he was certainly not kept in the loop. There were some interesting, a couple of really interesting documents showing Hillenkoetter going, just the head of the CIA, going to Truman, going to George Marshall in the weeks before the election, saying, look, we're using these private companies to fly in shipments of arms, but we have no control over these companies, and these initiatives and these projects are very dangerous. There's a real danger that our hand could be exposed here and undermine, and we would undermine the entire sort of election campaign. This is the head of the CIA going to other senior officials, but he was fairly marginalized. And in fact, in the aftermath of the Italian election, I think one of the key legacies, if you will, was the creation of the Office of Policy Coordination. This was a small unit which was dedicated solely to covert operations. This was the very first agency in American peacetime history whose sole remit was covert operations. When the history of the CIA is often cited, the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, is often mentioned as the precursor to the CIA. In many respects, the OSS, its true reincarnation after the war, after World War II, was through the Office of Policy Coordination. This was the unit that did all of the covert stuff. This was the unit that was engaged in all of the more controversial aspects or the most controversial aspects of covert operations. It would later be folded into the CIA in the 1950s, but the profound disappointment with what the CIA itself was doing in Italy led to the creation of an agency which would engage solely in covert operations. And this was supported by all of the key sort of senior officials in the Truman administration at the time.
Yeah, it's a very interesting read, that section of the book. And it raises, at least by extension, the issue of how Italian actors saw these events, the election and what goes on after the election in terms of where it fit into their understanding of, you know, Italian politics, but even more so this concept that you talked about, the Cold War. Did Prime Minister De Gasperi think of it as, you know, the election as this pivotal or very important moment in the Cold War, you know, struggle against the left? I was wondering if you could say more about the Italian angle on these events.
Yeah, so for De Gasperi, I mean, he was consistently trying to both reassert Italy's strength, its sort of maturity, if you will, on the international scene, emphasizing Italian national sovereignty, that its choices would not be dictated from the outside, but unfortunately, one of the consequences of this sort of line is that it's not very conducive to receiving assistance, particularly financial assistance, for an economy that was struggling. It was not conducive to helping the Italian security services build up its arms. There were obviously lots of restrictions and clauses placed on Italian military as a result of the peace treaty, going back to its World War II experience. So he was, throughout the post-war period, he was both asserting Italian strength, but also hinting at and emphasizing its weakness. And this is one area in which the language of the Cold War proves quite useful for him when in his discussions with the United States. Once the election of 1948, once the result is announced, for De Gasperi, he considers this as a vindication for his own approach, but also that Italians have made a firm decision that, as they had, that the Christian Democrats were the party who they would entrust to guide Italy's future. And this again meant not succumbing to every American demand, when it came to the use of, say, Marshall Plan assistance, the creation of a liberal democratic capitalist order was not the same agenda as de Gasperi. The path to post-war reconstruction and reform was a different one from the programs that were pushed by the ERP, the administrators of the Marshall Plan, and you see numerous tensions that come out in Italy's use of Marshall Plan funds in terms of reconstructing or reforming the Italian economic system in the aftermath of 1948.
Yeah, it plays in what you've just described, plays into the ideas you raise in the book of containing communism, and in some instances the nuances or the necessary correctives you have to use if you employ Gerlundestad's empire by invitation thesis, that it wasn't necessarily a straightforward kind of story of Italians and Americans working together on the same page to wage the Cold War. Very, very interesting stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Lundestad has his idea received a lot of attention, of course, when he first put this out, and it's a line that he an argument that he's sort of continued to make, tweaking it ever since. There are some interesting elements to it, but it's overly simplistic in the idea that Europeans across the board were happy to give up, were inviting in the United States. One it overlooks, obviously, the differences between a very heterogeneous European political body, but also within national boundaries as well. I mean, I mentioned a little bit earlier the number of competing political and social voices within Italy. It was very hard for one group to sort of step forward and claim to be representing all Italian voters or all Italian constituents. De Gasperi was the dominant political figure, but as I mentioned, he faced a lot of opposition from within his own party. The Christian Democrats win the election, but there remains a sizable opposition movement, close to over 30% still of the electorate still vote for Marxist left parties. And the Marxist left in Italy would continue to have a very strong influence in Italian political and social life throughout the Cold War and running up to the present day. I mean, many of the senior officials in Italian politics today, so many of them were formerly in the Italian Communist Party.
Yeah, Gorbachev had a lot of respect for the Italian Communist Party. If you look at his internal documents and just his arguments he's made, the Spanish communists and socialists as well. That's true about their influence in Italian politics. So where the book concludes, and once again raises interesting grounds, is with this idea of the perception of American success in Italy and how it influences U.S. policy in the late 40s into the 1950s. I was wondering if you could say more about that and maybe make reference to how it influences, in what ways it shapes the arguments of document NSC 68.
Yeah, so one of my conclusions or key arguments that I put forward here is that the Italian election, one of the most, arguably the most telling legacy of the election result was the emergence of a perception of success in American circles. Right? The supposed lessons of the election campaign seem to outline how the United States could wage a Cold War effectively, or generally as well. My aim here is not to just criticize these perceptions as false, but I'm interested, and one of the things I've tried to do in the book is to show how they emerge, but also the ramifications of them. So on the one hand, it leads to a very complicated future alliance between the United States and Italy. The Truman administration faces a very inconvenient ally in the form of the Christian Democrats. This was a group which the United States had placed a lot of emphasis, obviously, during the election campaign. They were considered as loyal partners who would help bring about the reform ethos of the Marshall Plan. They were the ones who would realize this. The years after 1948 showed that this was not necessarily the case. The Italians had their own program, their own priorities. The alliances with American labor, with the Vatican, would similarly be incredibly strained. This was one of the ramifications of this perception of success, a very difficult, rocky U.S.-Italian relationship. The other key sort of upshot is that it fuels the notion that the tactics that the United States used in Italy could be exported elsewhere, that this offered a blueprint for how you could wage a war without going to war, how you could defeat communism in other locations without risking World War III. Right? Western Europe was starting to consolidate, partly through European economic recovery. There's a big debate whether, you know, how influential the Marshall Plan was in this, but the Marshall Plan has obviously an important role. You have the formation of NATO shortly afterwards, the division of Germany. You start to see the division of the continent begin to crystallize. The discussion that American policymakers then turn to is, well, what opportunities does political warfare, particularly with the newly created Office of Policy Coordination, this covert operations unit, what does it offer us on the other side of the Iron Curtain? So you see this shift and this sort of evolution of covert tactics to start to chip away at and try to undermine communist influence in several Eastern European countries through underground activities, but also resistance movements, activities which would later manifest as prominent refugee organizations, emigre organizations like the National Committee for Free Europe, Radio Free Europe, a lot of these key psychological warfare initiatives, things which would be chalked down, would be labeled as soft power in later years, using Joseph Nye's definition. Many of these ideas have their origins in these discussions that are taking place in the late 1940s. And sort of one of my arguments is that many of these are informed by this notion that what the United States did in Italy was a success and needs can be exported and expanded.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that. What struck me about, especially as this, for lack of a better term, as these debates emerge about how to use political warfare in other areas, is that when they wrote up documents, especially NSC 68, about, you know, this global struggle for hearts and minds and the disadvantages that democratic governments were at, was how they all of a sudden didn't consult the actual specialists on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe when they came up with their arguments, that they were kind of basing it on one episode that literally was, you know, had nothing to do with the situation in places in Eastern Europe and parts of the Soviet Union, that an example was used in an ahistorical type of fashion. It reminds me of when I interviewed Joe Migdahl about his book, about how the Bush administration came up with all these theories about how Iraq would topple when they invaded because it was an authoritarian regime and people would rise up like they did in Eastern Europe. It's amazing how history sometimes gets lost when you think you have an historical example that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, hubris can go some way towards explaining some of these sort of decisions. But it's fascinating that the assumptions as to what officials thought was a success, or the reasons why certain events went in the way that they did, how they could be replicated elsewhere, is quite striking. as you mentioned, sort of the notion that people, Eastern Europeans would rise up and sort of risk their lives for these sort of refugee organizations, groups which had very little sort of popular support, very little presence on the ground, if you will. You mentioned NSD68, though. That's kind of an interesting point in the evolution and the challenges that political warfare sort of faces, if you will. For somebody like Kennan, political warfare, if waged effectively, would ensure that there would be no risk of a hot, overt, total military war. What NSC68 does, kind of interestingly and fundamentally, compromises this notion that the United States could wage a war, a cold war, a war short of actually going to war, because it introduces a vast ramping up of military spending, right? The development, obviously, of the hydrogen bomb. Vast amounts of resources are now being spent on bombs and tanks and guns and all of these instruments of hot war. But at the same time, it's also increasing the funding for all of these measures short of war, things like propaganda, things like covert operations.
Yep.
You have the expansion of the Office of Policy Coordination in the sort of 4 years between 1948 and 1952, which is when the OPC is folded into and merged into the CIA. No coincidence that this is the time that historians have termed sort of the golden age of the CIA, when it was under Alan Dulles in the 1950s, when it was particularly engaged in covert operations around the world. So NSC68 both ramps up the tools for both hot war and cold war, but it never reconciles the fundamental issue when it comes to political warfare, at least as Kennan sort of elucidated it in the late 1940s, that if you are to wage a war without going to war, you do not rely on your military tools. But this is something that NSC68 not so much rejects, but ignores, if you will.
Yeah.
It throws money at across the board. Once you have all of these tools for a military conflict, how then can you create an approach? How do you go about foreign relations that is based on all of these subtle measures? Based on coordinating your overt and covert diplomacy and overt and covert methods. And this, it's no coincidence, this is the time when someone like him becomes is out of the door, disillusioned. His long sort of lament against American foreign relations in the Cold War really starts to begin in this period.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I'm glad you raised it, and I have to apologize for taking so much of your time, but I have to ask you, if you don't mind, one more question about international history. What you do in this book is you bring in transnational actors, and by definition, you kind of engage in the writing of an international history. I was wondering what advice you might have to historians who are looking to kind of bring in the transnational angle and write good international history. What lessons might you have by writing your book?
Yeah, I must admit, I mean, I was incredibly fortunate in terms of my graduate work allowed me to spend a lot of time in the U.S., but also in Italy, and it was through finding interesting material in the state archives, and a lot of I draw on it quite substantially, of course, but there was the sense that this is only so much of the story. There must be more, particularly when you're seeing the discussions that the references within any of these correspondents about the importance of these non-state actors. One example, I mean, Henry Luce has quite an influential role in this, in helping U.S.-Italian relations in this period, something that you wouldn't necessarily pick up just by looking, going to the National Archives in College Park. I started picking up references to this in Italian documents and then in personal papers. Fascinating sort of side angles, and I suppose it was a case of just allowing yourself to follow hints and suggestions and not be just restricted to the state archives. I have to admit, on a personal level as well, it kind of brought me back to novels that I read when I was younger. I mean, I remember reading something like Ernest Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms. That was a book I really, really enjoyed. And I remember dipping back into it, and you see some of his descriptions of Italians. Of course, he's reflecting on World War One and sort of semi-autobiographical novel, of course, like reflecting on the pathetic weakness of Italians in World War One. And it kind of got me thinking about sort of the culture in which many of these political decisions and discussions take place. They're not entirely removed, you know. And as an international historian, that's one of the most exciting ways, I think, that our field is going in, that it allows you the scope to sort of explore these different avenues and follow these different tracks, really.
Yeah, well, what I find interesting, I've done some work with transnational angles, and every time I kind of go over it is how much both sides kind of use each other. And what I mean by that is, you know, government officials have, you know, they work with non-governmental groups when it suits their interests, and they frame it in their minds in certain ways, whereas the non-governmental group will, you know, work with the government because of the resources and prestige it brings, and they may have like a completely different understanding of what they're doing. What brings it to my mind is when I wrote about Soviet dissidents or human rights groups that worked with the government against the Soviet Union. They weren't exactly, you know, they were obviously against the human rights violations of the Soviet government, but they weren't celebrating Reagan-style free market capitalism or necessarily even hostile to the idea of socialism, which if you look at, you know, the way the Reagan administration framed them, they were freedom fighters for, you know, free market capitalism, you know, getting people outside of the state, so that those messages, you know, get blurred.
Yeah.
And what I like about your book is that you're able to bring out the tensions and the stories of the complexities of the relationship. And I think that's what good international or transnational history will do.
Thank you. Yeah, it's you're absolutely right. I mean, it's the multiple layers to these messages. And quite often they're boiled down by political actors, reduced to the lowest common denominator. But sort of the nuances to these messages, to the idea of fighting communism, it has numerous meanings and numerous definitions, and different actors break it down in very different ways. I think one of the most exciting and fun things for historians to do is to scratch below the surface of these terms and try to sort of problematize them and to understand what is it that people are getting at here when you have these genuinely international moments. And it has some importance to us as citizens as well, particularly when you see sort of politicians citing history in a very casual way often to sort of draw parallels to the present day, to sort of pause and to think, well, what exactly do we mean by terms like democracy or freedom or the citation of, you know, the Cold War victory or something which we hear time and time again, and it comes back.
Absolutely. I agree with that. It's interesting. I try to play with that in my undergrad classes about what the Cold War is, what it is, and why it's an inappropriate term, what ways it's a misleading term, and surprising some of the answers you get with students who are so far removed from it. I mean, I'm old enough to kind of remember, you know, going under desks when I was in second or third grade, you know, for nuclear testing. They don't have, you know, that kind of relationship with it. So, yeah, you raise some appropriate issues.
It's fascinating when, I mean, for my students as well, the vast majority of them have no living recollection of the Cold War. And for them, it may as well be, you know, World War II or the Seven-Year War, 100 Years War, you know, Peloponnesian War. Who, for them, it's just the past. So it's very important. One of the things I always try to do is to start to break down these ideas and again bring into sharper definition what it was that what was the Cold War, what did it represent, what lessons, if any, can we draw from them, and start to get them to ask questions. Both students, but also I think as historians and as the general public, as to you know how the lessons of history are sort of used or at least cited by politicians today.
Oh yes, and they're used very selectively, to say the least. I won't belabor the point, but Marco Rubio's description of U.S.-Cuban relations after 1898. Was very interesting in what it left out. And he said something to the effect that, you know, after the Spanish-American War, the Cubans and Americans got along fine. No one, you know, ever accused the U.S. of conducting imperialism toward Cuba. And I'm just like, wait a minute. I mean, even you can debate the merits of U.S. behavior, but that, you know, is a very questionable statement, to say the least.
Right. Well, and these are individuals who will have, or do have a significant role in political debate and the next presidential election, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Will be a prominent figure in at least in the Republican side.
I'm sorry for taking up so much of your time, but it's been a fascinating conversation. And before we go, I was wondering if you could tell the audience what future plans you have with your scholarship.
I've always been sort of interested, I guess, in the myriad ways in which American power, in the broadest definition, political, economic, cultural, ideological, how it's projected but also challenged. And sort of the work that I'm moving towards now is focused much more on sort of the challenge to American power, especially dissenting voices towards foreign policy. So the new project is looking at the rise of the sort of the transnational whistleblower, particularly during the 1970s. As a concept, as a term, it only emerges in the 70s, which is kind of sort of quite interesting in and of itself. So the project is looking at former national security and CIA officials who start to blow the whistle on secret American wars abroad. So I'm looking at a couple of individuals, looking at how they go about doing it, and also just as importantly in many respects, how the state responds to this new challenge. So I'm hoping it's going to be the first sort of historical work on a phenomenon that's very prominent today, of course, with whistleblowing, but also on a more broader level and perhaps more pertinent, sort of this debate on, you know, where the line is between national security and civil liberties.
It's a very interesting subject. In my class, when I teach at Ferris, I always raise the issue. One of the course themes I always use is liberty versus order. And I often try to connect the debates that, you know, from, you know, the 1790s, the American Revolution, and after that, to kind of debates we have about liberty versus order today. And the students tend to get very uncomfortable about talking about it. I don't know, American students in general are probably not as political as they might be, but it's an interesting argument or issue to deal with, because it's such a fundamental purpose of government to walk that line between protecting people and not becoming a tyranny, kind of the ways that James Madison, you know, outlined it, even in some of the Federalist documents. So I'm glad you're doing work like that. I think it's going to be an interesting take that a lot of people will, you know, make them think about important issues.
Yeah. No. Hopefully, I mean, it certainly made me think in sort of new ways as well as you go into these discussions and debates.
And just one further point, then I'll let you go. I'm sorry. I have to ask: do you plan on doing any research at the Reagan Library?
Hopefully, we shall see. Would you recommend it?
Yeah, I would recommend it. I've been there many times, and I don't know what this means, but I was stunned that it was actually opened on Christmas Eve. I was one of only two people in there doing research, and they tried to whisk me out before it closed at 2:00. And it was just a bizarre scenario of me and another person. Like the library staff was just looking at us like, get out of here now. We want to go home. But it is actually open on Christmas Eve, and a lot of plit times you would see or not think it would be open. But there is a lot of stuff there, and I think you obviously have to check ahead, but Yeah, well, I think it would probably be worth your while to do
well,
that.
Well, I'll certainly look out for that, and I think as much as anything else, it shows your commitment to research, to go on Christmas Eve. I don't think I would get away with that on the home front.
No, my my wife was not thrilled at my behavior. She thinks I'm a lunatic in many ways. So, well, anyways, it was great talking to you. I enjoyed the book. It should have a wide audience, and you've addressed many issues that, you know, I think show a new direction in U.S. foreign policy writing, incorporating kind of the top-down elite level with non-governmental. So I wish you the best of luck in the future, and thank you for talking with me.
Great. Thanks for having me, Christian. Take care.